here's a familiar sound, and feel free to fill in your town's landmarks as we listen to a bit of morning rush hour around Boston.
Lower deck, left lane breakdown at the end of the carpool lane. You want to be careful there. Tobin inbound heavy from just after.
The Texas Transportation Institute has a new report out saying there are 328 seriously congested traffic corridors in the U.S. That's just highways. Forget about city driving. Now, scientists are looking at the effects of the fumes from all those gridlocked vehicles, and they're finding some disturbing correlations between traffic fumes and autism, intelligence, emotional problems. Nothing concrete yet, but enough to make people wonder. Well, we want to spend a few minutes on this. For instance, research finds that exposure to emissions may heighten the risk of Alzheimer's and speed along Parkinson's. What if Aunt Millie's memory problems have to do with the fact that she lives by that traffic circle? Wall Street Journal science correspondent Robert Lee Hotz has been writing about the new research. Lee, you write that today a car only generates a tenth of the pollution it might have a car did, 40 years ago. But there are so many more vehicles on the road, and we're spending more time in traffic.
I'm told, for instance, that along the 10 worst U.S. traffic corridors, the average commuter every year spends an extra month sitting idle in traffic. And while that car or truck is sitting idle, of course, its engine is running and it's spewing various hydrocarbons and these very tiny, tiny nanoparticles. I mean, each one's like 1/1,000th the width of a human hair. So they're really a new component of traffic exhaust that they're just starting to look at. They're number of laboratories across the United States that have been examining the effects of these among the elderly, where they appear to cause emotional problems, cognition problems, learning and memory problems. It's research in particular in the Boston area, which I should point out is, I think, the eighth most congested city in the United States by a number of measures.
You don't have to tell us.
Well, but I felt obliged. It's bad, but, it's not as bad as in Los Angeles or in New York. But in any event, these cognitive effects add about 5 years to the person's mental age. At the other spectrum, to sort of linger on Boston for a moment, if we may, there's some work out of Boston University and Harvard recently that showed that children in residential areas where levels of traffic fumes are very high, children exposed to above-average levels of the black carbon that you find in traffic fumes, they did much more poorly on tests of reasoning, learning, cognition, compared to children living in less polluted areas. There have been similar studies conducted in New York, Beijing, in Krakow, Poland, all showing these similar impacts on children that add up to 2-3 points on standard IQ tests and other such things. And then just for context, that's, the same kind of intelligence testing hit that we observed, for instance, when leaded gasoline was still allowed and lead levels in the air were higher.
But isn't it possible that people who tend to live near a lot of these traffic emissions, sitting, breathing in the emissions from stalled traffic, let's say, by the George Washington Bridge in New York, which is just a horrendous spot, or on the 10 in Los Angeles, people who live near these roads, they tend to be, poor neighborhoods. Isn't it possible that these problems, these cognitive problems, come from other things in the area? Maybe the area is more industrial in general. Maybe, there's more smoking.
Well, I think you've raised a key question, and it's a key problem with all of these kinds of public health epidemiological air pollution studies, where you're trying to sort of relate a cause and effect, and there's so many causes potentially out there. Now, what I can say is that the scientists who conduct this kind of work know this problem perfectly well, and they struggle with it a great deal to sort out these side effects so that they can zero in on one particular factor. I mean, I know in the Boston studies, for instance, they were able to sort out education, tobacco use, other illnesses, a variety of things. These are people that had been followed for other public health studies for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, a great deal of background data on their medical and mental well-being that will allow you to sort out some of these variables. Now, let me talk for a second about a quite different study that actually zeroes in on this problem very precisely. It was done at Columbia University, still ongoing in New York, which I feel obliged to point out now is the world's second most congested city, United States.
What's number one?
No, Los Angeles.
Oh, Los Angeles. Okay, that makes sense. Okay. So yeah, the Columbia University, this is the Center for Children's Environmental Health?
This is the Center for Children's Environmental Health. A very talented researcher, Frederica Pereira, there, has led this study. And to isolate these effects, what she's done is she's taken hundreds of pregnant women living in New York and given them their own personal backpack air monitors. So literally, as these women go about their business during the day, they're wearing gas masks that directly monitor and measure the constituents in the air that they're breathing. And then they're interested in the effects and the long-term consequences for the children that are born to these women. And interestingly, as these each of these babies was born, Dr. Pereira and her colleagues were able to do some very clever genomic analysis, and they discovered that a particular nanoparticle in traffic fumes called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, quite common in diesel exhaust, that's a byproduct of fossil fuel combustion. They found that this actually left a mark on the DNA of the infant, a kind of signature smudge, what they call a DNA adduct. In any event, as these children grew up, they've been following them since 1998. There are now, you know, hundreds of them. They found at each sort of developmental stage some significant effects that were worse in the children who had exposure to the highest levels of these traffic fumes. Mm. For instance, at age three, you know, they were developing mental capacities fractionally more slowly compared to children who were born in less polluted areas. Yeah. By age five, their IQ scores averaged about 4 points lower on standard intelligence tests. And by age seven, they were much more likely to show symptoms of anxiety, depression, attention problems. Now, because of the careful attention to the chemical exposures prenatally and to the kind of biomedical and social and economic information that Dr. Pereira and her colleagues were able to gather about these pregnant women, they were able to sort out a lot of the variables and confounding effects that you mentioned earlier.
You also write about studies that show that changing traffic patterns, so we can take some of that stall time out of the equation, can reduce problems.
Yes. I mean, for instance, there are some very smart economists at Princeton University and at Columbia who've looked at the kind of the before and after congestion public health equation. After the introduction of EasyPass in the eastern United States, and in particular, they were looking at highway toll plazas in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And what they were able to show very conclusively was that if you look at the various indicators of maternal and infant health before EasyPass was introduced, when the congestion levels would have been high because everybody was stuck in line waiting to throw their quarters into the basket, and then afterwards, when you can just drive through at a good clip, by their measure, they discovered that premature birth rates dropped something like 10.8%. And at the same time, instances of low birth weight infants declined about 11.8%. Both of these are related for infants to cognitive problems, developmental delays, and kinds of things that you would see that would show up on intelligence tests or in trouble in school. So what this gets at, I think, is really very interesting, that there are ways of dealing with some of these public health problems, even when they're perhaps still very preliminary, by doing things that, you know, you would want to do to speed traffic anyway. I mean, New York City's done a number of things in this regard. They have recently installed a very elaborate, highly automated wireless traffic signal control system in the heart of Manhattan, one of the most congested places in a very congested metropolitan area. And it allows them to, in real time, monitor traffic flow. If they see, you know, congestion building, they can manipulate the lights to speed it up and keep the cars moving. And also by keeping them moving, they then keep pollution levels low. Recently, New York City's Department of Transportation re-engineered Times Square, I mean, one of the most famous and heavily used parts of the city. And by simply changing the pattern of streets, reducing traffic a little bit so that there were fewer traffic jams, the traffic sped through more quickly, the general air pollution levels there dropped 63%.
This would be an argument for moving towards not completely staying at a stoplight, but maybe stopping and going or turning right on red, those kinds of things. Again, keeping the traffic moving when it's safe, as opposed to having it sit there and idle.
I think that's right. It's an argument some traffic planners tell me for congestion pricing, just reducing the overall level of a traffic flow in a given metropolitan area. All of these things are controversial. You're balancing a variety of things. But, you know, people generally are in favor of things that reduce their commute time. I mean, I know that I am, and certainly the traffic jam's an artificial burden, and there are ways to eliminate them, and it's just fascinating and telling that there is this side benefit. Now, one of the things that's curious right now, you mentioned how tentative all of this is, and one of the big research questions right now is, well, what's the basic biology of this? How do these traffic fumes actually cause these brain effects? How do they damage the brain? Nature's given us the blood-brain barrier that protects neural structures. You know, it's a very open-ended question right now. Just earlier this year, for the first time, the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences, which is the federal research arm that looks at such questions, convened a science workshop to try and map out what would be the proper research avenues to get at these mechanisms. There are a lot of laboratory animal studies that are being done on this topic. You know, they're doing some very clever things in Los Angeles at the University of Southern California. They've actually constructed a special laboratory that's like a little microcosm of a downwind Los Angeles neighborhood, downwind from a freeway. They are basically raising rats that grow up on freeway air. And the air itself is actually piped in from, I think it's the 110, which is a very heavily used freeway through Los Angeles, where I think the average hourly traffic is something like 12,000 cars an hour. So these rats are, they believe, a good model for the experience of people living there. And you know, they're finding significant inflammation. They're seeing kinds of neural damage effects that you, in fact, associate with Alzheimer's disease and such.
So there may be another link there. And by the way, you know, what about if you're in the car?
Well, if you're in the car, it's interesting. These experiments are very hard to do. This is human subjects research. It's very restricted. You can't intentionally do harm to people without, you know, being closely supervised. But in the Netherlands, I can tell you that some researchers at Zuid University, they hooked up electroencephalographs to 10 volunteers, an instrument that measures electrical activity in the brain. And then they put them in a room and piped in normal freeway air, you know, heavily laced with traffic fumes. And they watched what happened to their brains while they breathed. And within 30 minutes of starting to breathe what would be normal sidewalk level air pollution in a heavily trafficked city, their brain activity started to sort of ramp up and got very, very high as an electrical measure. And what was interesting is that it continued to soar for an hour after they were brought back into clean air. Now, how does this ramp out over a lifetime of sitting in traffic and breathing this? No one knows. They do take this increase in electrical activity as a sign that the brain is under stress.
Robert Lee Hotz of the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much, Lee.
It is a pleasure talking to you.